You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, welcome back to part two of my conversation with Stacey Ann Chin about life, love, sex, slave play, politics, Me Too. We went everywhere.
I want to jump into that a little bit and talk about like these women who... Mentally ill. Where was your mother from?
My mother's from Chicago. She had me at age 14. And a realization I had just in the last year, this last few weeks, was, you know, I know my mother used to beat me so terribly, and my oldest sort of feeling that I've carried my whole life, my most underlying feeling, is I just didn't want to exist. Just didn't want to exist. Not wanted to kill myself, just didn't want to exist. There was nothing about life, whether it was money or fame or success, that was worth it. It's like, oh, okay, I had that. Okay, yeah, I really wouldn't exist. And I think that it fueled my acting, because it was like I would always act like, and let me just give so much that I might die at the end of this performance, because that would be great. Mm. And I, you know, started doing some plant and animal and fungi medicine, and that went away. And then I was in Peru, and it all came up really strongly, like just this overwhelming sense of, you know what, you're 57, there's no point in you being here anymore. If you die, your children will get a lot of money. Just go. There, you have nothing left to do in the planet. And James, who was the help, was integrating, he said, well, when you do your next journey, why don't you try to find that little child self and see what that's about? And the next ceremony, what came up for me was remembering, you know, my mother used to wear these long polyester nightgowns, and I would be naked, and she would be squeezing my head between her knees, and I would be suffocating in this polyester nightgown, and then she would be beating my bare body as I'm bent over, you know, squeezing her knees with an extension cord. And remembering the pain of these beatings that were so much that I felt like I was going to die. Mm. So I would have to leave my body in order to survive them. And what came to me was that she was beating me because I existed. Because my existence ruined her life. So she was beating me for existing. And it was like, oh, so that's why I don't want to exist.
And I mean, that whole, like, she has your head between her knees. That's remarkably intimate. You know, like, it's, you know, and it's localized in her erotic zone as well. Mm-hmm. And your head is, I mean, it's all so...
Yeah.
You know, tied up with all of what we've been saying. I mean, my mother is the opposite, as in she left me when I was born. And so, and then the abuse happened at the hands of other people.
Right.
And but she came back when I was 1 week, when I was 9 years old for 1 week. And she, like, abused both me and my brother for the week that she came.
Oh, Lord.
And then she left. But in my head, as a kid growing up, I always thought that, you know, like all the terrible things, all the things that I am that are, you know, falling short of being perfect would have been not so if my mother had stayed. Mm. So in my head, it's like my mother going was the worst thing that happened to me, even as the other things themselves were like, you know, sexual abuse and sexual assault and, you know, being abandoned and being mistreated by other people and beaten and all of the things that happen to girls who don't have mothers to protect them, who are actively protecting them. And so, you know, I have this in my brain. And then I went to Germany when I was 25 and found her. And I found her with a 7-year-old daughter. My sister is now 30 years old. And one of the struggles that my sister has was like, you know, my mother's mental illness affected her so badly that she herself struggles with like how she sees the world and, you know, how she moves through the world. And that is her story to tell. But watching her, you know, it kind of dawned on me that it was my mother's absence that saved me.
Mm-hmm.
Like my mother left me and saved me. Like my mother is so crazy and she creates all these stories. My mother is such a crazy like person. If you can imagine the guy from Catch Me If You Can, just make her black and Jamaican.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just make that character black woman Jamaican. And that's kind of who she is, going across borders, living in different places, like taking money and time and like deceiving people from place to place. And she actually, I went to visit her once to kind of take her and my sister back to the US to visit. And, you know, it happened about 4 or 5 times. And she, there's always a story about why she couldn't or how she couldn't. So I would buy the tickets. I would go. We would go through all of these things like for 2 or 3 days getting ready to go. And then like she would just not get on the plane, or she would like disappear last minute, or just a whole bunch of crazy stuff. And then one time she actually didn't come on the plane, but she came to the airport. And then she came with a guy. She jumped off the subway when we were heading to the train. And then she's like, I have my little sister. We've got suitcases. I'm like, this is fucking crazy. And then we get to the airport and I'm waiting to get on my flight. And then she comes hurrying in with this guy. And then she says to this guy, okay, thank you very much for everything. And he goes. And then she takes my sister and she's like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, and she tells some big crazy story about why it is that she can't go because somebody took the passports and blah, blah, blah. Anyways, I get on the plane and who am I seated next to? The man that she came in with. So I know my mother is prone to telling not so truthful truths, you know. And I said to him, like, who is that woman in the multicolored skirt that you came in with? And he's like, oh, she's this nice woman. She lives in New York. She's a writer and a performer. She just came here to visit her family members. She came to pick them up and things didn't go well. So she's going back now by herself. But she's a writer and she travels all over the world and she's written a book. My mother just stepped into my life and pretended to be me.
Oh, my God. Woo!
But, you know, and that's like, you know, I mean, I went to Canada the other day and I just discovered somebody came to my last one-person show and handed me a box of things that my mother was married to a man and then she got divorced from him in Canada. She was living with him for 11 years and he didn't know anything about where she was from or who she was and she was lying about a whole bunch of shit. So she divorced him. I mean, they got divorced, you know, after like 11 years. And then they sold the house and then she got half the money for the house. And then the next thing you know, she was living with the man who bought the house. And then she was about to marry who bought the house from her. And then his family came and be like, no. How you mean you're going to marry him? You're going to own the house 2 times. But, you know, I mean, that's this woman. She found a box in the basement of that man's house, her father, who was now had like, you know, Alzheimer's, and she found this box and she Googled all the names of like letters and stuff. And they found letters that I'd written to her when I was like 9, like, you know, asking her to come home or whatever. Like, I mean.
And so they gave you this box of yourself.
They gave me this box of things like pictures. And that's when I found out, because up until now, my mother has lived in Montreal, in Toronto, in Germany, maybe more than one place. She's lived in London. And there was a rumor that she had lived in Rio for a while, and the only reason people knew was because she had got sick in Rio and somebody in Rio had to call her sister in Jamaica or something. And then I found these pictures of my mother. My mother had been like an onstage performer in Rio, all these like flamingo outfits and, you know, like glittery sequin, like bathing suits. And I know nothing about that world. I don't know where she's from or who she's met or what she did there. But she had this whole other life in Rio that no one knows anything about. So now I'm writing this book trying to figure out who the hell my mother was.
There's this interesting thing about mental illness. Like, my mother was very much, in many ways, the most competent and brilliant of all of her siblings. but she was crazy and violent
yes.
as a loon. And you know, you could be having a conversation with her and it's going really, really straight. And then it will just turn.
Turn.
And you just don't. And now you.
And did your family admit that she was mentally ill? They just thought she was. She, you know, she's just like that. Oh, she knows better. She could do better.
Exactly. Nobody. Oh. I did not know my mother was mentally ill until I was an adult. And I found out because I was in an acting class and they'd given me a Spoon River anthology monologue. I don't know if you know this. It's like this monologues that I forget who even wrote them. But I had the one about the woman who the walls were talking to her and the cows were talking to her. Mm-hmm. And they told her to burn the house down. And, you know, I went in and I did that monologue. And at the end of me doing it, the teacher was like, you know, the character is mentally ill. And I'm like, what do you mean? No. That my mother has that happen all the time. Mm. And it wasn't until he said that, he was like, no, this is mental illness. Walls don't talk to him. Like, no, the walls talk to my mother all the time. And literally my mother could tell you things that happened that she wasn't there. I mean, she could look at a Rubik's Cube and make it work. And she'd tell you she was just on another level.
It's the same.
Yeah, there's these powers and things that they have. And in many cultures, those are the shaman. These people who are literally traveling to other places and can embody other spirits and stuff. They would be the person who the community would rally around and encourage them to go deeper into that so that they could become the healers of the community. We, of course, don't have that in America.
I've never been a believer in spirits or, you know, I'm like a real, like, 2 + 2 = 4. This is the science of it. I did my first degree in biochemistry, physics, and math. You know, even like my philosophy and literature, it's about like how these arguments go together to make this thing that I believe in work. And so I never believed in the spirits. And for a long time, I resisted. I didn't have anything to do with the church. I thought this was all bullshit. Like, you know, even people, close friends of mine who are spiritual, I'm the one who rolls my eyes when they're like, listen, you just have to, you know, about your chakra. They want to talk to me about like my chi and my aura. And I'm the one who rolling my eyes. Like, get the fuck out of here with this fucking chi and shit. You just need to earn the money and like... Go find a job and pay a rent. That's how life works. Not, you know, I don't sit around chanting money into my fucking account, right? So I have this like resistance to anything. But when I was on Broadway in 2001.
Deaf Comedy Jam, Tony Poetry nominated. Jam, yeah. Deaf Poetry Jam,
I have family in New York. And I would say to them, I'm on the show. I think you guys would really kind of dig it. You should tell me when you could come and be on, you know, get some tickets or whatever. And they would never, ever respond to anything. And then, like, I also was traveling before that. So they would be like, call me up and say, you know, LaToya's having her baby shower. Do you want to come? And I'm like, no, I've got to go to Denmark for the weekend. I've got to go to London for a week. You know, I'm going to Swaziland or South Africa. And they were like, okay. And then one day my aunt, you know, we had these... advertisements for the show that were on the side of buses. And she called me up and she goes, what the hell? I see your face on a bus here. I say, what do you mean? I tell you, I'm in a Broadway show. It's just advertisement for the show. And she says, so you're really doing this thing? I'm like, yes, I'm on a Broadway show. I am on TV sometimes talking about this thing. This is what I do. What do you mean if I really do it?
They thought you were your mother.
They said to me, oh, we think you have the same thing your mother have that make you just tell lies.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody believed me for the longest while. But there's a part of my mother, you know, I keep saying to people that my mother's dream for her life came true, but not for her, for me. Mm. So I'm walking through the world as an artist, as a performer, as a thinker. You know, here I am being invited by Tonya Pinkins to have conversation about sex and class and race and all of that. That's what my mother wanted for herself. Mm. She wanted so much more. So when you said that your mother was like, you know, she had all this power and all of this way of like seeing the world. And like for 11 years, she was with this man in Canada. And this man didn't know that she really wasn't born in Britain, like she said.
Right.
And the next door neighbors that she was really, really close to for 11 years, and one of them was like her best friend, the husband and wife, one thought she was from one country, the other one thought, and they're still together. They've been together 40 years now. And when I went back to Montreal to speak to them, it was in the conversation between all three of us that they were like, no, she's British. No, she's Canadian. I mean, you know, she's Jamaican. No, she's British. And these people have shared a pillow for 40 years, and how my mother has navigated with them has made it so that each of them believe two different opposing narratives about her.
Yeah.
That's smart.
Yeah.
It is. That's smart.
It is smart.
And she's like, you know, been with like the most amazing people. And people have like this trail of shame that they've been with her. Mm. Because when it is that it becomes obvious or apparent that she is this kind of crazy, nut loose kind of person, they don't know what to do with the fact that they were so entrenched.
Because the feelings you had were real. I mean, the feelings mm-hmm. that they had were real, and now they want to deny that. I have had this thing where I have psychodar. Like, if I'm attracted to someone, mm-hmm. there's something wrong with them. They're a sociopath or something. Like, that is what is my attraction. No, it's really true.
Yo.
And that's how I know. And so for a while, I just would date people that I didn't feel anything to, mm-hmm. because if I feel that, I know that feeling means you are crazy. You are mentally ill or you're a con person.
But I would challenge you further to ask, aren't we all slightly a little bit ill?
No.
I disagree with you. I think if we were to, you know, I think that mental illness and mental wellness is on a spectrum and we're okay. all somewhere on it. And maybe you're talking about the people who are far left, you know, in the process.
Far right. Like, I put them on the right.
Okay. That they're far right. I'll go with you. You know, these people who are closer to the side of the continuum that is mentally ill, and then you have people who are closer to the side of the continuum that is mentally well.
Well, I'm gonna agree with you, because to me, our whole society is mentally ill. Okay, like this bread and circuses impeachment shit is like, that is the height of mental illness, you know, like that people want to be deluded and watch these crazy. It's like, it's just a show. The whole of our reality is a TV show. Mm-hmm. And that people are walking around and they're tuning into it and they're spending their time. It's no different than watching a streaming show.
It's a part of the social media world we have where our entire existence is about presentation and curation.
Yeah, but our whole world is curated. So when do people go to reality? Like, do they even do it at home with their family? I mean, one of my friends was married to a man, and 27 years later, he comes in and he tells her, I may have given you a sexually transmitted disease. And she's like, okay, well, I'll go to the doctor. And he's like, you're not going to divorce me? And she's like, no. I mean, I'd like you to stop, but no. Mm. But it turned out that he had been keeping journals of all of his sexcapades for the 27 years of their marriage in their house. And he left them out. Mm-hmm. He just assumed she would read them. She had not, because she valued privacy. So they were living together, living this completely different world. Mm-hmm. And then it turned out he wanted a divorce, but he was trying to force her into the divorce. And so he ultimately ended up divorcing her. But the story he told the world was that she did it.
But it's also this weird thing where people, you know, I find that people are unable to be in situations where they're uncomfortable now. So no one wants to have any conversation that might rub you the wrong way, or that your opinion might be different from mine. You know, I already see that you and I could disagree quite heavily on an issue, and we would argue it out and cuss, and then next week you'll be like, you coming for coffee?
Exactly. I love that. That's,
but people can't do that nowadays. Yeah. It's like, you know, even this notion of like, oh, that's awkward, and you hear it on the news all the time. Like, oh, that's very awkward that like the president didn't shake Pelosi's hand. What the mean? Of course it should be more than awkward. Awkward is like, okay, if you open the door and I'm like wiping myself while I'm mid-period. Like, that's awkward. But
yes.
But this man trying to fuck over the country, and they're trying to hold him accountable, and the entire Republican senator core, you know, like gang is like pushing back and making sure that he can do anything he wants and making him into a king. That's not an awkward fucking situation. That's like beyond awkward.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like, so, and this notion of like, I hear it with my kid now, she's 8, and she's like, oh, that was awkward. And I'm like, in your life, if you are living it with any kind of honesty and push forward with truth, your whole life is slightly awkward.
Yeah. If you're engaging with people genuinely, it's always awkward.
Yes.
And that's, to me, I try to tell, like, my students are always this, oh, I don't want to do that. Oh, that's triggering. Oh, I'm like, first of all, if you're a performer, people pay to see you triggered. That's the job description.
Yes.
If you don't want to be triggered, then don't get in this business, because that's what people pay for. And, you know, if you are interested in having a relationship with somebody, it's not about avoiding the awkward. It's about going into the awkward, going deeper to have a relationship and understand hand and struggle with somebody so that you actually can know them and have an awkwardness.
The closer you are to someone, and I've even seen this within the context of partnership, whenever people because the closer you get to someone, the more they rub up against your stuff, the more conflict, the more friction you will have between you. But nobody want to have that. Everybody wanted to be like smooth and like on Instagram, where every picture is like the right exposure, the right filter. It's got like the right tone. I mean, people do this shit like they start laughing and then do a selfie. I'm like, come on. Click. What is that?
The presentation of life.
The curation of life.
Yeah, the curation
is an art show. My whole being is an art show, which is problematic. We have to be able to embrace the awkward. We have to be able to like teach this next generation coming up, because God knows they can't. Anybody who is like uncomfortable, which is why like I run from the teaching as much as I can. If I need the money and I need the health insurance,
these children,
my God, man.
The teaching is hard.
I can't tell you that the sentence you write is shit, because
you won't get hired again because they will write a bad review about you.
But how is it that you're going to know the shit is bad if somebody don't tell you it's bad, if you don't know nothing about whether it's bad or not? Your acting, your hairstyle, your breath. God damn it. If my breath stinks, somebody please tell me. That's caring for me so I could go brush my teeth.
Yeah.
These people, they don't want to hear anything uncomfortable. And people love to talk about young people, but it's not young people. It's a whole fucking generation. Like, all these old people, everybody's like, mm-hmm. And to me, that's also like not Jamaican culture shock. When I came here from Jamaica, and people would do this like slightly pressed, pursed lip that kind of looks like a smile, but not really a smile. I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? You want to look like you're Bernie, like Ernie and Bert. Like that's, what are you doing? Are you smiling at me? Are you inviting me into conversation? Are you like pretending that you acknowledge me so that I won't say that you're racist? Like, what is going on with that smile? Can't you just say good morning? Or just not say anything, like turn your back, and I know you don't want to talk to nobody black. But God damn it, man, like be a person. Like, nobody wants to flesh, it's everything. Like,
well, that thing you said, that's for me a piece of gentrification. Like, they move into neighborhoods that have been occupied by other people, and then they walk down the street like you don't exist.
Yeah.
They walk down the street like you're invisible. They just like riding by, and they can just blur out their eyes to the fact that they're singing and dancing and people walking, and they just, you know, are walking by like you don't exist. Soon you won't, because we're going to buy you all out. Mm-hmm. And I like push against that when I'm walking through Harlem. Like, hey, how you doing? Mm-hmm. And then there's a jump like, oh, like, no, you moved into our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. This I often feel like gentrification is a form of chemotherapy.
Talk to me about that, please.
Well, you know, in neighborhoods of immigrants, of gray people, beige people, like, people of color, there's life. You smell the cooking, you hear the accents, you see the colors. Mm-hmm. Everybody's on the street. You go out on the street because you can't afford air conditioner. So when it's cool out, you out on the porch.
Arguments happen in the street.
Right. There is a life. Mm-hmm, all mm-hmm. of life is coursing through.
Yes.
Then we get some other people move in. And it's like all of the life is killed.
But it's
the sounds, the smells, the taste.
But it's interesting.
Gone.
Don't they move in for the life?
Of course. The life is what brings them. Well, also, they move in because a lot of times there's a political strategy. Like in Chicago, after the 68 riots, my daughter's father was working in the county assessor's office. And so he was privy to meetings and hearing things that black people get to hear because white people treat us like we are invisible. Like, if we told the truth, we knew no one would leave us or listen to us anyway. So we know all their truth. Mm-hmm. And so he was privy to the conversations where they said, let's give these niggas that stretch of the lakefront. And that's where they put the Robert Townsend homes and all the projects on the lakefront in Chicago. Mm-hmm. They said, let's give that to them. And in 30 years, we'll blight it and take it back. So there's a political urban planning strategy.
To what end?
To what end it is that they give you an area that they can't afford to buy, like that real estate wise, it's too expensive. So they do some get government money to put underprivileged
low
people
income
there. And then they say, you all are not developing the area sufficiently for economic eminent domain. And so now we can drop the prices to rock bottom and sell it really cheap. And now we make a whole lot of money because you all destroyed the area. So we blight it. And then we take it back and we make a lot of money. And that, there's books about it in Texas, in Illinois. That is economic strategy.
I have nothing to say. Like, I'm kind of shocked by that. As so being so like purposeful.
Very purposeful. Very intentional.
Yeah, that's crazy. You know, when you think about it in terms of purpose, I always like envision gentrification as just, you know, people kind of looking at the life of that neighborhood, wanting to walk in and, you know, snuff it out and take it for themselves. And then we, you know, I 12 years ago, I had a dog, you know, I had a dog in Crown Heights. And then I used to be like just one in like a bunch of like, you know, black people who had a dog, and we would walk and we would talk. And now, 12 years later, I have a kid and I have a dog, and the neighborhood has been gentrified out and my building is mostly white. And I go to the park and I feel like I am in their space.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm, you know, they all meet each other like, hey, Joe, hey this, hey that. Oh, where are you? Oh, you were there. What time did you leave last night? And I'm like, nobody invited me to this party that they're having in my neighborhood.
It's in your building. You weren't invited.
Oh, my God. And they all know each other. They all know each other's dogs. They watch each other's dogs. And I feel so kind of excluded from whatever community is happening in these blocks that I've lived in for 20 years. And then I'm looking at a place to buy and like trying to figure out. And, you know, I went to the loan people are telling me, well, maybe you can get a loan in a different, you know, city.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, you just like coming out the side of your mouth telling me, black woman, immigrant who came to New York City and helped to build it for 20 years, you telling me that I should just get up and leave.
Yeah.
And then what is affordable again? They keep putting up these affordable, in quote, apartments, you know, $1,700 for a studio apartment. What the hell does that, who is that affordable for?
Right.
Donald Trump and his funny looking children?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't, you know, it's like, and I don't know, you know, and any down payments they're asking you for, and you can't get a whole, I don't know what we're going to do. I don't know what we're going to do. What's the answer, Tanya?
We're going to keep living. I mean,
definitely.
I mean, we are going to keep being. That is not, I don't even worry about that. Like,
I'm about to beg, borrow, and steal. Perhaps you can set me up with your Dom sub community. Maybe I can make some money that way.
We're kind of very spiritual, airy fairy. We are very much.
So nobody in there have $100,000 they want to put on a down payment.
You know, it is all about, these are some powerful women.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, this is what I want. I want some, these white women who are weeping all over the place and saying, what can I do? What can I do to help? Fucking help me with a down payment so I could buy a house in my neighborhood. How about you help me
to
do that?
Make that happen. I have no doubt, Stacey Ann, that you could magnetize that for yourself.
Yes, and will sub-dom for money, for down payment.
No, I don't even think you need to know that. I think maybe the kind of power and energy you have,
you could do that.
Now, I had asked you before you came if you would do a poem.
Yes.
But would you do the one that you did at the 50-50 by 2020?
Which one is that? The one about the black women?
Was that it at 50-50 by 2020?
I can't remember.
I think so.
Let me get my book.
Yeah, because I mean, you're so powerful.
Tell
like,
them a joke while I run and get this.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
All the jokes I like are kind of off color, but it's you can't say that. So here's my favorite joke. There's this plane and it's flying across the ocean. And please, this is no offense to Kobe or anybody else who's died or had lost people in the plane crash. But there's a plane crying across the Atlantic, and all of a sudden the passengers hear, and everybody's like, "Whoa, what's going on?" And the captain comes on and he goes, I know you heard that sound. We are having some difficulties, but we've decided that if we could just lighten the load of the plane, we'll be able to get to some land. So we're asking permission from everybody if we could drop all of the luggage and the cargo in the plane so that we can get to safety. And people are like, of course, drop the plane. So you hear that, all the luggage is going. And so then the plane is going smoothly along. And then all of a sudden, more turbulence. They're like, okay, we thought y'all that was
missing,
enough.
Y'all are missing the physicality of this joke. You're missing the visual. You are completely not getting the whole situation here.
So we've got, you know, we wait low, lighten the weight, but we need to lighten the load a little bit more. And so we're going to have to ask for volunteers to jump off the plane.
I see.
And there's silence. And it's like, look, we're all going to die, or a few of us can sacrifice our lives so that the majority of us can live. And it's just silence. There is no one who is volunteering their life. So they're going along. It's turbulent. The captain says, look, we don't have much time left. So I'm going to just have to do this democratically. We are going in alphabetical order. So I want all the African Americans to step forward. And nobody moves. So he says, okay, then we'll take all the blacks.
Okay.
And nobody moves. And so next he says, okay, then the next group will be all the coloreds. And this little girl tugs at her mom and she says, Mommy, aren't we all three of those? And her mama says, no, darling, today we's niggas.
And I like the fact that there was like room to self-identify. The young folks would like the fact that there was room to self-identify. Okay, so I'll read this one, and if this is not the right one, then
there's anything you read and read, okay. It's powerful. So tell us the name.
So this is for
which book is this from?
This is from my latest book called Crossfire, A Litany for Survival. It's a nod to Audre Lorde. Tsunami Rising. It's called Me Too, Too. In the balance of human biology, all bodies are created equal. Everybody is about 70% water. Regardless of race, religion, gender, sex, or sexual orientation, we all die after about 7 days without drink. But the idiots obsessed with category have decided that a double X chromosome designates me subordinate to those with an X and a Y. Intersect those two X's with the fact of my blackness, and my existence is now coded as dangerous, hostile, a direct threat to the endurance of the white patriarchy. And everybody knows that white men have spent eons, centuries appropriating what they wanted. The gold they found in Africa wasn't enough, so they submerged human bodies head to toe in a swamp of our own urine and feces. They dragged us across violent waters. Many of us drowned or young rather than let them live at the mercy of white men and their sons and their grandsons and their grandsons' sons. Just to keep breathing, some of us became one-dimensional. In the public imagination, in real life, in books, we had to become one thing or the other, spinster or mother, victim or virgin, damsel or whore. Some of us went underground. Some of us let go into that sunken place. Others revolted, took up arms, crawled through sewage, defied geography to build new lives in new cities. And that's how the fuck I find myself in Brooklyn, spending my nights reading tales of Nubians bathing naked in the Nile, Kushite queens equal to kings, all of them praying to a black woman named Isis, the most powerful goddess among gods. And I imagine if I were her, if I were Isis, I would use my might to smite every motherfucker who ever looked at a little girl with lust in his flesh. I would exact vengeance on behalf of every black woman who has disproportionately borne the weight of racial and sexual violence, while everybody in the suffragette movement and the black civil rights movement and the LGBT movement turned a blind eye to her swollen lips, mouthing, me too, too. Someone please help me too get him off Me Too, Me Too, Me Too. For centuries, black women have endured the culture of rape and racism combined. For centuries, the world has stood silent while black women and girls were bullied by black men and white women alike. For centuries, anyone who wanted to hit something or own someone, they could decide we were it without consequence. Anyone could tag a black woman, a dark girl, the universal punching bag. For centuries, rape was a word black mothers never spoke aloud, but every black daughter knew what it meant. It meant lie still. It will pass. Keep quiet. It meant ignore that girl who screams too loudly. Don't you dare shame this good black family. And then one day something brilliant happened. A black woman named Tarana Burke inspired wealthy white women to say, me too, too. And herein wriggles the strange rubric of America's particular strain of racism. Ironically, the viral mobility of the Me Too hashtag was only possible because a white woman with power, retweeted a black woman's words. Two words which unleashed a wildfire of public testimony, pulling the shroud of sexual violation from the shadows, shoving it onto primetime TV. Yet, 12 years after that first Tarana Burke's Me Too moment, black women are still largely missing from the public dialogue about sexual assault. And we, the black women, are so tired of being disregarded. If you gave black feminists any room to speak honestly, if you gave us any room to speak honestly, this is the letter we might pen to you, white feminists, you whose crying consistently drowns out the sound of black suffering. Dear weeping white woman, even as we cannot find safe space to show you where or when or how we were torn open, we are only holding this sorrow in to keep our hearts from exploding. We are unable to process any of our pain with you because we are exhausted from the centuries of holding you and your children. We have a hard time trusting you. Even as you stand here weeping, we have a hard time trusting you because you have never been able to stand up for us or stand by us. And we are tired. We are exhausted from explaining ourselves. And if you wish to know any more about the genesis of this rage, this iron white rage, please go and Google us or read Bell Hooks or Brittany Cooper or the blogs of the bevy of white women writers your white publishers are too afraid to publish. For centuries, we have been carrying the weight of your white fragility, year after year, marching for everyone else's freedom, protesting everyone else's sorrow but ours. Well, this crazy mad gaggle of global witches and hags are done braiding beads of silent acceptance. Simply put, in this century, black women intend to take up a whole lot more motherfucking space. Black women are crafting a collective response to centuries of being under everybody's water. We have become a rising tsunami of fury, come back to take back what was carried away without consent. And while we're still here being candid, I might as well confess to you that I don't give a fuck if you don't like me or my big mouth, black like my lover's ass. It has never endeared me to the gatekeepers of white civility. My proclivity to speak the unspeakable is essentially the only defense I have against this indefensible violence of your man-made history. Inside my house, inside my Brooklyn house, there is no shadow talk of birds or bees. We trade indecipherable metaphors for concrete words that do not confuse my daughter. I tell her, your mouth, your elbow, your hair, your arms, your legs, your vagina, your whole goddamn body belongs to no one but you. And if you ever feel even a tiny bit unsafe, you open your mouth, you scream for help. If anybody at all does anything that makes you feel uncomfortable, you tell me and I will always believe you, my daughter, in a world that so regularly demonstrates how much it hates us. This is what it means to be assigned the label of black and girl. And yet, we continue to survive. To thrive. To arrive into adulthood with the ability to laugh and love and wear hoop earrings and tight skirts and found social movements to liberate other motherfuckers from bondage. If any of this sounds like I'm speaking your story, this comb be for you, my love, if you have ever had to argue that you are no less deserving than your white counterpart. I am speaking to you and for you, my love, if you have ever been inspired by the magic of black women with thighs and asses that move mountains in their stride. If you have ever been told you speak too fiercely from the thick lip of your own truth. If you have ever been called a girl like it was a fucking insult. If you have ever been called bitch, you step forward now if you are itching to light a fucking fire, a bonfire in the house of the white patriarchy. Come stand with black women now. If you want to be free like Harriet Tubman, weapon in hand, wading through the unfriendly waters, her power compelling the freedom of even those who did not want to be free. If you desire to be confrontational like Sojourner, if you wish to be audacious like Audrey, antagonistic like Angela, gangster like Winnie Mandela, angry like Assata Shakur, you come roar with us at our rallies, sit beside us in schools, sing with us in church, stand with us where it matters, vote with us and vote for us at these motherfucking polls. Travel with us in the virtual, in the flesh, over these waters they have used against us as weapons, across these lands of this rock we all call home. Let us use the fire to crack the ground wide open with an uprising that will never again die down. Let us say to them, no more water for them. We go use fire next time. What we say, no more water, fire next time. No more water. We use motherfucking fire next time.
Ooh. Ooh. I'm in tears.
Thank you for letting me do that.
Oh, thank you. You are a force.
I mean, how do you remain as radical, as provocative, as, you know, take no prisoners? One of the ways in which I kind of hold on to my voice is that I'm not attached to an institution, so I can fucking say what I want and not have to kowtow or explain it. Or if I get in trouble, then I don't have to explain. How is it that you have, for a whole life, been attached to so many institutions that seem so powerful and still keep this attitude of take no prisoners, shoot now, talk later?
I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, having been abused so terribly that there's just nothing that anybody else can threaten me with that I haven't gone through. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, we're not going to hire you. Oh, you're difficult. Like, oh, okay. Okay. So it is from that space of, like, what you going to do to me that hasn't already been done to me, that was far worse. And growing up in a crazy household, we're trying to hold on to what is reality, and my sanity in that has meant that when I find something that feels so clear and right for me, I have to hold it. And I have to hold it in the face of any story that you're going to tell me.
But how you get hired is a question.
Me money. I got hired a lot because George C. Wolfe believed in my talent. Mm. And, you know, six of the Broadway shows I did were George C. Wolfe.
Mm-hmm. George C. Wolfe, if you're listening, produce Motherstruck.
Yeah, George C. Wolfe. I mean, George C. Wolfe has a lot to do with it. Hal Prince gave me my first gig. Mm. And the fact that they were comfortable having me in their rooms until they weren't. Mm-hmm. And when I get in the room, I kick ass. And so, you know I'm difficult. And if you want to have me in the room, you have to expect that that's what's going to come with me. Mm-hmm. So I actually have been turning down a lot more jobs because I'm less patient, less tolerant with the ignorance. And I'm like, you know what? I don't want to make y'all uncomfortable by doing me. So I'm not going to even come in your room, even though you think I might bring something. I'm not, because I'm really radical now. I'm at the end of my life. And it's like, it's just really radical. I just made, you know, my first feature film. And it is about this election and the people that put them there. And it's a sociopolitical horror because that's what we're living in. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's remarkably inspiring because I've just like avoided institutions. I don't apply for grants. I don't mess with big institutions because I know that what comes with that space is.
Yeah.
But not having the institutions means, you know, I have to pay for my own health insurance.
Yeah.
You know, I can't, I don't have a job letter to take to anyone that can say, hey, give me a loan for a house.
Right. The golden handcuffs do bring a lot of things. But for me, if the price of that is my soul, I just couldn't live with it. Yeah. I just couldn't live with it.
Yeah. But it's good to see someone who is still doing work and have done work for so long. It's nice to see it. It means that, okay, even though it gets difficult, that, you know, I should press on and keep on doing my voice. Hold on to my voice. Don't consider this selling out business just because you need something.
And we're in the pivot. We are the women of the pivot. It's pivoting. It is shifting. It is about to shift. I like that.
I'm going to get a t-shirt that says, we are in the pivot, because that moment, being in the pivot, is what makes us hold on when it is the hardest.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you know it's coming, no matter how rough it gets, no matter how orange it gets, then you can still hold on. So thank you for that. Thank you for the inspiration. I mean, I liked being here and talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. I can't say any more. But thank you, Stacey Ann Chin, and you are welcome back anytime. And I hope you will invite me to your home.
Next one.
I love these conversations. You can come to my home, too.
Absolutely. I will be there if you ask me. Big, 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 big love. And thank you for, you know, thank you for having me and, like, for having a space that we can have these, like, ridiculously crazy conversations that are mostly unwelcome elsewhere.
Let's do it again.
Ashe.
You are listening to Tanya Pinkins' You Can't Say That and my guest, Stacey Ann Chin. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can. I'm Tanya Pinkins. This is part of the Broadway Podcast Network, produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals, edited by Derek Gunther, music by Anthony Norman, available wherever you get your podcast. And visit me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and let me know what you'd like to hear me talk about. For more information, visit bpn.fm/YCST.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.